Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
Israeli troops pushed deeper into Gaza today on a mission to destroy Hamas rocket launching sites and tunnels. This is the first major Israeli ground offensive in Gaza in more than 5 years, and it follows more than 2,000 airstrikes against Gaza, which failed to stop Hamas from firing its rockets into Israel. Shahadi Al-Kashif is with the BBC's Arabic service. He's in Gaza City. And Shahadi, what can you tell us about what it's like there and the fighting today?
Well, it's a very bad situation in here in Gaza. The Israeli artillery shells are still fired to Gaza, to east of Gaza area, and also in north of Gaza Strip, in the areas of Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and also in east of Jabalia, which is the people in there, the residents start to evacuate their homes and come into the central of Gaza City and Jabalia City. Also, the UN said that more than 30,000 from the Palestinians leave their homes under a heavy fire from the Israeli, heavy bombing from the Israeli army that start the offensive, the land offensive operation against Gaza. And now they are based in the 34 UN schools in the central of Gaza City, without any supplies, without any chance to get help before 10 days from here. Anyway, the situation also in the ground, we can say that Gaza is get fire from the sky, from the land, and also from the sea, because the Israeli boats participate in yesterday until now to shelling, to fire shellings in the Gaza City, and also in the northwest of Gaza Strip. The resident in there, they call us in here and our bureau in Gaza to say where we should go. There is no safe places to go Gaza without shelters, and also there is no any sign from the Israeli army to the people where they should go if they ask them to leave their homes from yesterday until now.
And we should say there is a fence that surrounds all of Gaza, both along the Israeli border and along the Egyptian border. It's not as if people who live there can flee the country in a case like this.
That's right, because Gaza is not ready for this kind of escalation. I mean, the people in here, they lived in a very small area. We're talking about 1.8 million from the Palestinians, over 70% from the refugees. And also, we can say that the situation before this escalation is very bad. Gaza, more than 500,000 of the Palestinians without water for more than 5 days in here. And there is no electricity for more than 8 hours in a day. And also, in the same time, Gaza without fuel, Gaza without any chance to anybody to leave this area to run away from Gaza. So the situation that just looks like a jail, but it's a very big jail in here.
Well, let's listen to Mark Regev, the spokesman for the Israeli government. He spoke to the BBC earlier today.
It has to be stressed, we didn't want this round of fighting. Israel accepted the Egyptian proposed ceasefire 2 days ago. We accepted it yesterday. It's Hamas that has condemned both sides to the continuation of the fighting.
What is Hamas saying about Israel's new offensive?
Well, Hamas said that Gaza is under aggression. That was what Sami Abu Zuhri, Hamas spokesman, said. He also added that Gaza now get more than 5,000 Israeli airstrikes. More than 20,000 from the Palestinian homes is destroyed partly or completely from the Israeli bombing. And we're talking about 272 Palestinians had been killed. We're talking about 2,000 and more from the Palestinians is get injured. About 80% from them is from civilians. So Gaza cannot accept any kind of calm agreements if Gaza did not get any guarantees that Israel will stop the siege and put an end to the siege on Gaza.
But of course, Israel is saying we're going to do this until Hamas stops firing rockets into Israel.
When we ask Hamas leaders about that, they said that Hamas signed agreement with all the Palestinian faction with Israel in 2012, and they said that we already was commitment of the calm for more than 2 years, but Israel did not give anything to Gaza through that period.
How are people doing in general? Can you go out on the streets right now in Gaza?
After 10 days from the Israeli operation, they allowed to the people to go just for 5 hours. This was from the UN initiative between both sides, Israel and Hamas. But this is not enough because the people need to get money from the banks, and the banks is also closed, and people need to reach to the markets. But there is no any transportations in Gaza City. And also there is no food because the farmers cannot reach to their farms because it's very close to the Israeli borders, and this is still under bombing from 12 days. So the situation is really very bad. That's what the Palestinians said in here.
Are there Israeli soldiers out on the streets?
No Israeli soldiers. All what we can see, there is a high smokes from the area in north and east of Gaza City. I think the operation is a start yesterday, but the tanks are still very close from the borders. So the residents in the area, which is very close from the borders, is very scared that tonight the tanks could, come into to their neighbors, which is still not ready for this kind of, offensive.
That's Shahadi Al-Kashif with the BBC's Arabic service speaking with us from Gaza. Shahadi, thank you.
Thank you.
And now to Israel. Earlier today, we spoke with Daniel Estrin. He's reporting for NPR, and he spent the day on the Israeli border with Gaza talking to civilians and Israeli army reservists. I asked Daniel what those reservists have been telling him.
Well, I visited a gas station near the border with Gaza where there were about a dozen reservists hanging out and waiting for orders. One infantry reservist named Neev told me he feels that Israel has not chosen this war and that his wife back home is scared. She's with their baby girl. They're running for cover every time there's an air raid siren. And he told me, our children can't go outside and play in peace, and we have to enter Gaza. And that's been the sentiment among many of the reservists I spoke with today. They're nervous about getting that order to go into Gaza. An Israeli soldier was killed in the ground invasion. And I think maybe what's also playing on their nerves is all the waiting. I visited an army encampment just along the Gaza border. The soldiers there were eating dates, hanging out, knowing that at any moment they can be sent in to fight inside Gaza.
And what about civilians in the area? I mean, you visited a kibbutz amongst other places. What are they saying? What have they been doing as this ground invasion gets underway?
Well, I visited one kibbutz near the border with Gaza. It's surrounded by barbed wire. It's kind of a surreal thing to look at. And then when you enter, there are nice manicured lawns with swing sets. And then I visited what they call their war room. It's a bomb shelter. There were young Israeli volunteers, and their job is to coordinate with the army and with people inside the kibbutz. Every time someone leaves the kibbutz, the village, they have to tell the war room. They're tracked all the time. So if there's an emergency, the war room can inform everyone in the village who's there, to, let's say, lockdown. Like yesterday morning, towns like this kibbutz were on lockdown when the army was concerned that militants had snuck into Israel through a tunnel and were going to carry out an attack. And despite all of this, they said they're used to this kind of life.
So that's what civilians are telling you along the Israeli border with Gaza. Do their reactions differ from Israeli citizens you've spoken to in other parts of the country?
That's a good question. Here in the south, they're sort of on the front line. The posters on the highway as I was driving down here say things like, we're a strong front, and there was one poster saying, cut off the electricity in Gaza, it's the moral thing to do. And there are a lot of very strong feelings here. There were a number of young Israelis I met on a hilltop sitting on a sofa, sitting on crates with binoculars, looking at the Israeli attacks in Gaza just across the way. And they said that they were happy to see that after so many years of rocket attacks on their town, they were finally seeing Israeli attacks on Gaza. That's a sentiment I've heard from a lot of young people here on the front lines. I met another man who I'm actually sitting in his house here right near that hilltop. He was out washing his car for the first time in all of these days of the Israeli offensive. And he says, finally, when the ground troops went into Gaza, there haven't been as many rocket attacks on his town, and he can go out and wash his car in peace. And he's hoping that this ground invasion will bring a few years of quiet, till the next round of fighting. And for him, that's worth it. And, contrasting that to some of the other voices in the other parts of the country. During this particular Israeli offensive, there have been rockets landing deeper and deeper into Israeli territory, people running into bomb shelters in the Tel Aviv area, even in Jerusalem. And so many people feel that this is something, that this ground invasion is something that needs to be done. Although there have been a lot of anti-war demonstrations. There were two anti-war demonstrations in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv yesterday. There was a busload of anti-war demonstrators, Israelis, anti-war demonstrators, who came down to the border town of Sderot, where I am now. The police actually sent them back home because they said it was too dangerous with all the rockets here. So there are a lot of different voices in the Israeli public, pro and con this war and this ground invasion.
Daniel, and finally, what is the Israeli government saying? What is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying? Because we've been reading that many thousands of Israeli army reservists could potentially be called up for this ground invasion. Has the government said what it thinks would be a successful conclusion to this invasion?
The conclusion question, the endgame question, is a great one, because the mission, according to the prime minister, is clear. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the ground invasion has a pinpointed objective, which is to target tunnels that Israel says Hamas has built deep underground in Gaza and has used to try to infiltrate Israel, like in an attack yesterday. And so the prime minister says that the only way to attack these tunnels is not only through airstrikes, but also on the ground. So Israel is portraying this mission, this ground operation, as a very pinpointed mission. But there are some military officials who have been saying that this could take a few weeks, and it's unclear how long it really will last.
Daniel Estrin reporting from the Israeli border with Gaza for NPR. Daniel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And of course, we are also following the plane crash in Ukraine. President Obama spoke at length about it earlier today.
Men, women, children, infants who had nothing to do with the crisis in Ukraine. Their deaths are an outrage of unspeakable proportions.
The president speaking earlier today.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a former reporter for The Washington Post, and one of the most prominent immigrant rights activists in the country. So it's no surprise that he recently traveled to the border for a news conference and vigil for the tens of thousands of children crossing into the United States from Central America. Vargas is also an immigrant himself. In fact, he's been living in the United States without legal documentation for years. Born in the Philippines, his mother sent him to the U.S. in 1993 when he was just 12. And as he recently wrote in Politico magazine, Vargas does not have a single U.S. government-issued ID. Which is why, when he tried to board a plane in McAllen, Texas this week, he was temporarily detained by U.S. immigration officials. Jose Antonio Vargas joins us now to talk about what happened and what it says about the current immigration crisis on the U.S. border. Jose Antonio Vargas, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciated your introduction because you kind of connected the dots that I think I've been doing some interviews in the past couple of days. Is I went to South Texas, to McAllen, to document and to chronicle what's happening at one of the shelters where a lot of these kids, these Central American children, are being processed and being received. So it was natural for me to go down there. Mm. And because a lot of people have been saying, a lot of cynical people have been saying, oh, was this a stunt? Did you go there to purposely get arrested?
Well, I want to ask you about that in a second, but I actually want to back up a little bit first, because, I mean, as we noted, you don't have any U.S. government issued ID. You travel on a Filipino passport.
Yes.
But did you realize that they were going to do an immigration check when you boarded the plane in Texas? Because usually they don't necessarily do that for domestic flights in the United States, but they do in certain places along the border.
Actually, I've been traveling for the past 3 years, you know, as an openly undocumented person, and I've done maybe 250 events in 43 states, and this was the first time that there was a Border Patrol agent sitting there checking with the TSA agent at an airport. Doesn't happen at San Diego Airport, didn't happen anywhere in Arizona that I visited in. So no, this is actually the first time that's happened, for me at least. But it tells you, though, about what it means to travel in this country without papers, right? For me, because I look the way that I do, I rarely, you know, no one, when I show them my Filipino passport, no one kind of bats an eye. They just assume that everything's fine. But that just kind of shows the cracks in the system.
Yeah. Well, you were detained for
It was only about 8 hours.
Yeah, it was less than a day.
It wasn't that long.
What's your status now vis-a-vis your interactions with U.S. Immigration officials? Do you have to appear before them again?
Yes. Actually, well, for the first time, somewhat ironic, this is the first time that actually the U.S. government, at least, you know, the immigration government here, acknowledges my existence. They haven't done that before. So now I have to appear before a judge to figure out what they want to do. I mean, they gave me what you call a notice to appear, kind of a warrant for arrest event. So basically I have to carry these pieces of documents that says...
Well, acknowledge your existence in terms of your interactions with immigration authorities. I think,
exactly, think
many Americans have acknowledged your existence in other ways. I mean, you won the Pulitzer Prize. You've testified before Congress, et cetera.
People don't understand that to be undocumented, right, means that you don't have proper documents. You don't have proper papers that show that you're supposed to be here legally.
Well, what I wanted to ask you was something that you had hinted at earlier, that you were detained for about 8 hours.
Yeah. And
during that time, many immigration activists took to social media. They took to, you know, they put out press releases, et cetera, calling for your release, which is what made others think this was a publicity stunt. Was it? Or you're saying that it's not?
No, it was not. I mean, this is where it gets really interesting. So once I realized that I was trapped there, I had to figure out how I was going to get out. I had to get out of there somehow, right? It was either I get out of it through being driven through a checkpoint, which meant that the person driving me would be smuggling me if they got caught, or I had to get out either by flying, or I stay in McAllen until they pass immigration reform. So those were the three options, right? Or actually, one of my friends said, hey, why don't you get somebody to get you a private plane? Like, are you kidding? Like, that's completely out of the table. So I had to pick one of those three options. And so my lawyers and I talked, and like, they thought that flying, right, would be for me, given that I flew into there, flying out was the only really way I could go out. But we had to figure out, I had to email all of my friends and, of course, talk to my family members because, you know, my grandmother is, like, the person that I worry about most. And I had to, like, make sure that if I got arrested, which was likely, that she wouldn't freak out and, you know, she's going to think, you know, that everything is going to be fine. But because of that, we had to figure out what we're going to say. So the moment, like, maybe about 30 seconds before I went into the TSA line at the airport, I tweeted out, I'm about to go through the checkpoint. I mean, you know, the airport, I don't know what's going to happen.
Right, and then that let everyone know what
exactly
was the back.
Exactly, and then we told...
If I may just interrupt, and forgive the interruption, because I don't want to run out of time to talk about the big issue here, which is what's happening right now on the border. Because many people say that your detention and your subsequent release, you know, it isn't really related to what's happening on the border because you no longer have ties to the Philippines. You've been in this country for years. You don't have any strong immediate cultural connections to the country of your birth. So your release from detention was understandable, whereas these children who are currently crossing the border still do have those strong ties. And so therefore, maybe their circumstances and treatment should be different. Do you draw that same distinction?
That is where you and I do not draw that same distinction.
I'm not necessarily drawing it. I'm just reflecting what people have been saying about what happened.
There, by the way, I have a tie to the Philippines. My mother is in the Philippines. I haven't seen her for 21 years next month. That's the tie.
Mm-hmm.
I came down there last Thursday before knowing what was going to happen because I wanted to look in the eyes of those children and I wanted to make a statement that when you see those children, you think of possibility. We talk about them as if they're insects on our backs. What is happening right now is not only a humanitarian crisis, it's a moral crisis. The fact that we're actually thinking of sending them back to the hell that they just came from, are we serious about that? Is the only piece of legislation this Congress is going to pass a piece of legislation that deports children?
Well, Jose, if I may just ask, we've got less than a minute to go. What do you think what happened this week tells you briefly about what many call sort of the patchwork nature of how immigration and immigration enforcement is done in the United States?
Well, I mean, from the very beginning, when I outed myself 3 years ago, this is why, against the advice of most of my lawyers, I wrote in detail what I had to do to survive. That's why I wrote in that political piece, I have no single piece of government-issued ID, right? I am, in some ways, I've been practicing here a radical form of transparency just to kind of show people what it means to live in this kind of a situation. And if there was any proof that how broken and how cracked the system is, this is certainly one of them.
Right. Jose Antonio Vargas is an immigrant rights activist and a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist as well. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Airlines around the world are rethinking some of their routes after yesterday's crash in eastern Ukraine of that Malaysia Airlines jet believed to be shot down by a missile. Malaysia's prime minister has said that the plane's route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur had been declared safe by international authorities, but the U.S. FAA had warned pilots not to fly over the area near where the crash happened. So what will airlines do now? Michael Regan of Bloomberg News joins us now. And Michael, first of all, we should say that Malaysia Airlines was not the only airline that had flights over this general area. But why would anyone want to fly over an area that was where there was even the slightest possibility of trouble?
Well, you know, it just so happens that this area sits right below what is a very popular flight path if you're traveling from Asia to sort of northwestern Europe. And obviously, if you're an airline, you want the most direct route to, you know, not only save on fuel, you might not necessarily, depending on the route, have an airplane capable of making the route if you have to take a big detour. So there were, you know, the number of flights going over this area had been reduced, you know, pretty significantly since the conflict broke out. It went from, you know, about 300 to 400 flights a day down to about 100 a day as of yesterday, according to some flight tracking services. So, you know, many airlines obviously did avoid it. Qantas, several other Asian airlines were avoiding it, but there still were a lot, you know, who basically believed that it was a safe route based on what international aviation associations had told them.
Well, and they have to make a decision based not just on the safety of the route, but also how much fuel they're going to have to carry. It becomes much more expensive, right, to fly if you're not going in a straight line to your destination.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
And so what are some of the other areas around the world that have to be avoided by aircraft? I'm thinking right now, I doubt many airlines would want to be flying over Gaza, for example.
Right. You know, at any given time, there are numerous restrictions on airplanes across the world. Even if you think about the United States, I mean, obviously, an airplane is not allowed to fly over the White House or Camp David. The FAA has, you know, restrictions on North Korea. Obviously, you're not allowed to fly over places like Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. The big difference, though, is the height restrictions. You know, It's rare around the world in a place of conflict for either side of the combatants to have a weapon able to reach, you know, 30 some thousand feet into the air, right, to take down a plane. So, you know, it's obviously not something you have to worry about if you're flying over, you know, say Somalia or Sudan, where maybe the best weapon they have is sort of a shoulder fired rocket. Those just simply can't reach that high in the air. So there's, you know, restrictions on low flying and taking off and landing. But, you know, many hotspots you're allowed to fly at 30,000 feet above and really don't have to worry about.
And, Michael, what does this mean for Malaysia Airlines now to have two planes lost in just 5 months?
You know, obviously it's not good. I mean, their stock is, you know, taking another hit, down about 11%. It's really, you know, they've already had to sort of put off expansion plans. You know, and there's speculation in the market that the Malaysian government might actually, you know, want to break up the airline. Hmm. There's not an analyst who covers the airline who recommends buying the stock. So it's, you know, it's definitely a perilous time for them.
When you think, of course, in this country about TWA, Flight 800, TWA no longer with us, and ValueJet also after that crash in the Everglades, it doesn't exist anymore. They were both swallowed up by other carriers. Michael Regan of Bloomberg News, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Bolivia made a major change to its child labor laws this week. The Bolivian Congress passed legislation that would allow children as young as 10 years old to work on the condition that they also attend school. The bill's sponsors say it acknowledges the reality that poverty is already pushing many Bolivian children to work, and they say the new rules will provide safeguards for those working children. The bill was signed into law yesterday, much to the dismay of groups such as the International Labor Organization, or ILO, and Human Rights Watch. Joe Becker is Advocacy Director with the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. We spoke with her just before the bill had been signed and began by asking her why Bolivia was taking this step.
Well, late last year, there were some demonstrations in Bolivia by working children appealing to lawmakers and the president to actually lower the age of employment. These were kids who said that they needed to help their families put food on the table and to meet basic needs and, you know, didn't want to be in violation of the law. But what we've seen at Human Rights Watch, you know, with our research on child labor, is that there's often very strong pressure on children from poor families to help their parents out. And, you know, that they feel a very strong sense of responsibility. I've interviewed girls who have endured beatings from their employers and, you know, extremely long work hours just because they feel that sense of obligation to their parents. But if you take away that family pressure and ask the children, the vast majority would say that they would rather be in school.
Bolivian President Evo Morales actually met with those children when they protested last year.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. He did. And at that point, he made a promise to them to reevaluate the existing law. And that's how we sort of ended up in this situation where Congress has approved a law that would lower the legal working age to 10.
Does it apply to all kinds of work?
It would allow outside employers to hire children as young as 12 and kids to work on their own as self-employed, for example, as street vendors from the age of 10. It would not apply to the most hazardous forms of work. So, for example, work like mining, operating, moving machinery, work underground, operating vehicles, welding, that kind of thing, would still be prohibited for children under the age of 18.
Lowering the legal age of labor seems to be going against what has been a global trend towards trying to eliminate child labor.
That's right. It's completely out of step with the rest of the world. The proponents of the law say that, you know, children in Bolivia need to work out of economic need. They need to help their families. And that lowering the minimum age of employment can actually help address extreme poverty. But in our view, this is really sort of a perverted view. Child labor does not alleviate poverty. It perpetuates it. When children go to work at young ages, they're more likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to be stuck in low-wage labor for the rest of their lives. They're going to earn less as adults, and they're more likely to send their own children to work.
Yeah, and I'm seeing that other proponents in Bolivia of this law say that, again, this is their claim, that an advantage to passing this law is that it would help the government oversee, regulate, perhaps ensure better safety amongst young children who are working, that basically by legalizing it, you bring everything above board. Do you think there's any merit to that?
Well, I think we need to look at an alternate argument as well, that if you lower the age of employment, it also encourages parents to send their kids out to work. If they know that it's legal, they may see it as more acceptable, and we may actually see more children working than attending school. Yes, it may be easier to regulate, but in many countries with, you know, where children are working, we don't see, you know, effective remedies in that way.
Now, Human Rights Watch has said that instead of lowering the legal age of children to work, that the Bolivian government ought to take more significant long-term poverty alleviation measures. I understand that Bolivia already does have a subsidy that it provides parents who do send their children to school. So what else, ideally, would you like to see the government do?
Well, the current subsidy is certainly a very good first step. It provides families with school-aged children about $28 a year if their children are in school at least 75% of the time. But there are some studies that show how that program could be improved. So, for example, there's much better school attendance in the city than there are in the rural areas. In rural areas, almost half of Bolivian children never finish primary school. So targeting that program, increasing subsidies to both rural children and also the children who are most likely to enter the workforce, for example, the 6th, 7th, 8th graders, have all been suggested as remedies that could strengthen that program. Mm. We've also seen in countries, other countries, that anytime you increase access to education, you're likely to keep kids in school longer and keep them out of the workforce. And some really easy ways to do that is to provide free lunches, for example, for students, provide them with their school supplies, with additional stipends for transportation. Those are all proven measures that can increase enrollment and lower child labor rates.
Now, I see that Bolivia is among more than 150 countries that have ratified the International Labor Convention number 138, that specifies a minimum age for employment. And that minimum age is 15. So it would seem that this new Bolivian law clearly contravenes that international agreement. I mean, is there anything the international community could or would or should do in response?
Well, certainly, you know, other governments should, you know, pressure Bolivia to, you know, abide by international standards. The International Labor Organization also has a committee of experts that examines countries' compliance with international labor law. And certainly the committee is going to be quite alarmed by this move by Bolivia and will take a close look at it and will press Bolivia's government to explain and also to change what they're doing.
According to the International Labor Organization, child labor worldwide is down by about a third since roughly the year 2000. Is the new Bolivian law then a setback for what seems to have been a good trend in terms of reducing the number of children who are forced to work?
Bolivia is definitely, you know, out of the norm. The ILO says that what created that drop was increased access to education, efforts to alleviate poverty through the kinds of stipends that Bolivia has tried to implement and other countries have as well, and stronger child labor enforcement, including, you know, strong minimum ages of employment. So, you know, while we're seeing a lot of progress in ending the use of child labor worldwide, we're afraid that Bolivia's action is going to facilitate it, not reduce it.
Joe Becker is Advocacy Director with the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
President Obama spoke about Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 today, saying the passenger plane was shot down yesterday over the part of eastern Ukraine controlled by pro-Russian separatists. The president also said the separatists have been receiving a steady flow of weapons and training from Russia. And he confirmed that one American, Quinn Lucas Schantzman, was among the 298 people killed from a dozen countries.
What we've seen here is just in one country alone, our great allies, the Dutch, 150 or more of their citizens being killed. And that, I think, sadly brings home the degree to which the stakes are high for Europe, not simply for the Ukrainian people.
The BBC's David Stern is in Ukraine. And David, there's a lot of finger pointing going on about who might have used a missile to take down the plane. But what is the Ukrainian government saying?
Well, the Ukrainian government says a lot. You're absolutely right. There is an enormous amount of finger pointing, accusations and counter accusations, as could be expected in a situation like this. Nobody wants to take credit for what is absolutely a horrible incident. The Ukrainians are saying that it's directly it's the pro-Russian rebels that brought down the airplane. The Ukrainians say the rebels fired an anti-aircraft missile, but they lay the ultimate responsibility with the Russians because they say the Russians have been orchestrating this insurgency from the very beginning, providing them with fighters, letting fighters go across the border, providing them with weapons, and ultimately providing them with these anti-aircraft systems. And so the words just today coming from the Ukrainian government have been very harsh, very strong. The prime minister actually used a couple of curse words to describe what had happened, and said that Russia had crossed all lines. The
president, Petro Poroshenko, said that this was an act of international terrorism, and it's a wake-up call to the world about Russian aggression. So you can see they are not only are they attacking Russia, but they're also expecting a reaction from the international community.
Well, we have some tape here of Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk calling the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight an international crime and a war against the world. Let's listen.
Everyone is to be accountable and responsible. I mean, everyone who supports these terrorists, including Russian Federation and Russian regime.
Now, the Ukrainian government has also called for an international probe to determine who may have brought this plane down. But David, I'm curious, do we know who's even in control of the crash site at the moment?
I think control perhaps is the wrong word, but the plane crashed in the rebel-dominated territory. And so ultimately it is the insurgents. And when I say insurgents, let's point out that these are both local Ukrainians, but also quite a few Russian citizens, including the actual leaders. A number of them are Russian citizens. And so they are the ones who are going to be able to say yay or nay. So far they're saying yes, the international investigators can come to the site. But at the same time, they say they're not going to introduce a ceasefire. So it begs the question of how effective an investigation can be if there's always the threat that fighting could break out at any moment. And this is right in the heart of the combat zone.
And David, where are you now? Because one question we're wondering is how much has this inflamed the region as a whole?
Well, I'm in a town called, or a city called Dnipropetrovsk, which is a major industrial city in the east of the country, but not within within the conflict zone. It's the next region over from Donetsk, which is where this crash took place and where the fighting has been going on. And there have been a number of concerns that the fighting could spread to other predominantly Russian-speaking areas in the industrial east. Dnipropetrovsk is one of them. Another one is Kharkiv. But it isn't. It hasn't affected it yet. And many reasons why. One of them is because it's the local governor, a man named Igor Kolomoisky, has managed to keep a lid on things. But there is very much the fear that this could escalate. You can use any number of words to describe what has happened. A pivotal moment, a game changer. The fact that this has turned into such a humanitarian disaster and an international humanitarian disaster gives a lot of people pause and makes them wonder if this is the moment that we'll look back on and say this is when it all exploded.
The BBC's David Stern reporting from eastern Ukraine. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, 189 of the 298 passengers and crew on that Malaysia Airlines flight came from the Netherlands. Among them, people who were on vacation or traveling to see family. There was a renowned AIDS activist and a Dutch senator. Earlier today, the vice president of Malaysia Airlines in Europe, Haupt Korter, spoke in Amsterdam.
We have opened a local contact number here in Amsterdam for the next of kin. That is our main priority at this moment, to look after these people who are suffering at this moment.
To find out more about the response in the Netherlands and about the Dutch lives lost, we turn now to Robert Chessel, who's a journalist based in the Netherlands. And Robert, just tell us about what it's like there today. It must be very difficult.
It's been a shocking day all around, from emanating from my very own home out into the rest of the country. It's been just a personal shock, and there's a tremendous amount of grief. And the way it has unfolded slowly but surely, with the death toll climbing and more people realizing that someone close to them personally has been killed in this disaster, it's just horrific, really horrific.
Well, and when you say your own home, tell us about this. Your family has a personal connection here.
Yeah, it was quite a shock. We knew about the disaster, though we had no idea the numbers of dead. This morning, we had left it last night with the latest report saying something like 55 Dutch victims. And our daughter, our 19-year-old daughter, came into our bedroom. My wife and I were simply talking in the morning over a cup of coffee, and she came in tears. And, well, honey, what's wrong? We said. And she said, well, my friend Nick from high school, his brother was killed. And she was just, you know, distraught, and we tried to comfort her, only to find out that just an hour later that not only had his brother been killed, but his mother had been killed, and another brother, and that this family is reduced from, you know, a family of five to, you know, to almost nothing. And it's just horrific to think that this young boy is on his own now.
Just terrible. So many stories like that, Robert. Now, and we know that two of them are about well-known figures. There was an AIDS activist and a Dutch senator. Tell us about them, if you can.
Well, Joep Lange used to be the president of the International AIDS Society, certainly one of the most important AIDS researchers in the world. He and dozens of other researchers, I understand, were on their way to a major AIDS conference in Melbourne. And now AIDS research itself has become, in a sense, a victim because all these people have been killed. And so, you know, who knows what a tremendous amount of knowledge and research may actually have gone down with these people, in a sense, because of, you know, not everything that a researcher knows is already on paper. So it's Joep Lange is certainly a major loss, and many, many prominent people from the world of AIDS research have spoken out about that. And then there's the Dutch senator Willem Witteveen, a veteran in Dutch politics, not a very, very well-known Dutch politician, but certainly locally in the region that he's from, it's a tremendous shock that Willem Witteveen went down with the plane as well.
What are officials doing for victims?
Well, there's been a crisis center set up at a hotel near Schiphol International Airport just outside of Amsterdam. Hundreds of family members of those killed in the crash have been gathering there. There has been an outpouring of, you know, condolences and sympathy from the government, from Dutch King Willem-Alexander and his wife, Queen Maxima, who signed the condolence book, and Dutch government. Buildings are all flying their flags at half-mast today. That order came directly from, you know, from the king, presumably. That's not normally done for anyone who's not an official of the state.
That's Robert Chessel, a longtime journalist in the Netherlands. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.